Good evening. My name is Jason Johnson, an alcoholic.
Amen.
I'm sober today only by the grace of God, the solution I found in the big book, and most importantly, a little bit of grace that some of the guys in my home group showed me. It is bright. It's an honor and privilege to be here. I want to thank Bill for inviting me. Jewel, I don't know where he's at. I lost him ever since he picked me up. Oh, he's way over there. He dropped me off. I haven't seen him since. He took me, I guess it's called the Hood, to eat waffles at Waffle King. And as we were walking out, I had to explain to him, Jewel, I don't know if you noticed, but I think I'm the only white guy here. And he just laughed at me. And I said, all right. And then I went to my room, and I thought it was going to be a different kind of weekend. And this biker guy showed up, Robert. So this is a tough crowd. You know what I mean? I don't know what to tell you. But it's an honor and a privilege to be here. And yes, those lights are bright. You told me to ask you that. Sobriety date's 11:30:07. I have a home group. It's called the Men's Lunch Bunch. We meet on Wednesdays at noon in Gresham, Oregon. There's a guy, John. I don't know where John's at. John's a friend of mine from Oregon, and he knows that meeting. And then I have a service position there. I am the assistant garbage taker outer. I was the garbage guy, and then I missed a business meeting, and they voted me out. So now my job is to walk around to make sure the guy who takes the garbage out takes it out. And so I have that. They're not really impressed that I'm here tonight. And I hear everybody saying you don't have any expectations, but that's a lie. You know what I mean? We all have expectations. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to tell you how I got my sponsor in Alcoholics Anonymous, and that way you'll lower your expectations and realize what this talk is going to be like. I had been coming to Alcoholics Anonymous for 3 years. And I was going to one meeting a month, sometimes two. If somebody I knew was having a birthday, maybe three. But I went to this one meeting every month because there was a speaker's meeting. I was the raffle chair, and I just went there to get my half of the money. And eventually, yeah, I know, I had to pay it back. A lot more than I took. And there was this guy named John. I thought he was the president of Alcoholics Anonymous because he had all these guys that followed him around and did whatever he told. I call them Notigans. You know what I mean? Because every time you go to a meeting, they're the ones out there greeting. And you're like, oh, God, not again. And then they share. You know what I mean? They talk about God. They talk about the sponsorship. They talk about the big book. They talk about the solution. They talk about it's the same thing every time. You know what I mean? Every one of them. And they just drove me nuts. And so I try to avoid those guys as much as possible, get my share of the money and leave. Well, it was a Saturday of that night, and I got in a good argument with my wife, and I asked her for a divorce, and she said no. And I was like, you can't say no. And she said yes. I said no. She goes, I'm going to go to the meeting. Maybe you should go. And I said, I'm not going to Alcoholics Anonymous anymore. I'm going to quit. So what I did is I went into my daughter's room, which I call my office, and I typed up a letter of resignation to Alcoholics Anonymous. It's funny now, but it's kind of shady. But you know what I mean? And I got a big book, and I got the Bible, and I wrote some quotes in there, and I wrote some stuff out of there, and I dated it, and I signed it, and I folded it, and I went to that meeting to find the president of Alcoholics Anonymous, that guy that I couldn't stand. And, and I seen him over there greeting and grunting, you know, hugging everybody and smiling. So I walked up, I handed him this letter, and I said, read this. And so he reads it, and he just starts laughing, like really loud. You know what I mean? Like people are staring at us laughing. You know, and I was like, and I said, he looks at me and he says, no. I said, what do you mean no? He says, no, I'm not going to let you quit Alcoholics Anonymous. And what accidentally came out of my mouth is, well, will you sponsor me then? Yeah. No more laughing. Straight just. He just got really serious and he said, are you willing to go to any lengths for victory over alcohol? And I'm thinking to myself, I just asked you to sponsor me. You know what I mean? That's way past any lengths. And I said, sure, yeah, I'm in. You know what I mean? I didn't know what I was doing. I was just standing there trying to figure out what just happened. How come that letter didn't work? And then all I remember saying is, he goes, I'm going to give you some directions. And I said, well, there's no directions in Alcoholics Anonymous. The only suggestions. And he says, well, I'm going to give you 5 directions. And if you don't want to take those directions, I suggest you go find somebody else. And that didn't make me happy. I was already going to do whatever he said. So then he started laying this stuff out to me. He said I was going to have to pray twice a day on my knees. Once in the morning, once at night. He said he heard me share at a meeting, so my prayers are going to be in the morning. Please help, thank you, amen, nothing more. God don't need to hear any more from me at all. And at night, if I stay sober and I don't kill anybody, I need to say thanks. And he says, you start doing those things. And I said, all right, I can probably do that. You're not going to be around, so you won't know. And then he said, I had to call him every morning at 6:02 a.m. I don't have a job, so I don't know why we're getting up at 6:02. But I said, fine. You know, he told me I had to read 2 pages out of the big book every day for the rest of my life after we got done going through the big book together, which I thought was another thing was out of whack. And then this is where we had our biggest dilemma. He said I had to go to 5 meetings a week, 2 where he was at. And I was like, 5 meetings in 1 week? That's like a 6-month coin. You know what I mean? Well, you got to be kidding me. You know? He wasn't kidding. You know what I mean? So it was 5 meetings a week, 2 where he was at. And I said, fine. He said, try not to drink between the meetings. And if you do those 5 things, Jason, your life is going to get better in spite of you, not because of you. And it changed my life. You know? And if you're new here, you're wanted, welcome, and needed in Alcoholics Anonymous. You truly are. You know? And I know there's a lot of guys in here. My first 2 retreats I went to, I was scholarshiped. And that's the best 2 retreats I ever had. You know what I mean? Because nobody never looked down at me. They just made me feel part of. And there wasn't a lot of people I was part of at that moment in time. And so if you're new here, you're wanted and welcome and needed. You know, I need to probably start getting drunk because this gentleman down here told me I had to be done like in 20 minutes. And I'm good with that. You know, I grew up in a family where my mom and dad got divorced when I was like 3 or 4 years old. So my dad took off, and I only saw him one other time down the road. But, I mean, he just left, and my mom was an old hippie. I was born in 68, so I guess that was an age where people were living in the back of trucks with houses built on them, or we lived in a teepee sometimes. Sometimes we lived in a backyard. Sometimes we were in the woods. You know, I just never knew where I was going to be living. And, you know, I saw stuff happen to my mom, and I seen stuff happen to other people, and stuff happened to me that probably I shouldn't have seen at that age. You know what I mean? But I didn't know any different. I knew that when we moved to town and we finally got a house, that sometimes I'd go to sleep and nobody would be there. I'd wake up, everybody would be there. Sometimes I'd go to sleep, everybody would be there. I'd wake up and nobody would be there. You know what I mean? It was just hit and miss. My thing was I would always slip underneath the coffee table at our house because I could hear the music and I could hear people talking and nobody could step on me or hit me. And it was just a safe place for me. You know, and that's just how life was. It didn't cause me to be an alcoholic. That's just the way it was, and that was my survival skills. You know, when I was going into the first grade, and the reason I know this is because it was the day before I was going into the first grade, the night, I was at home watching Happy Days. I don't know if anybody knows what Happy Days is. There's some old people here, so you probably should. And I'm watching Happy Days, and I have all the blinds down at the house. I have all the lights on. I have the kitchen stereo in the kitchen, this little radio we had going. I had a black and white TV in my mom's room going, and I'm watching Happy Days with all this noise. And the phone rings, and sure enough, it's my grandma. You know how grandmas are. I don't know. I had this grandma let me know way too much. You know what I mean? So she's talking to me, and she's asking me questions like, do I have my clothes laid out? Have I ate dinner? Have I taken a bath? You know, the stuff that grandmas do. You know, and she's explaining to me that when I go to school tomorrow, I need to listen to other people, and I need to play nice with other people and all these kinds of things. And I'm getting kind of annoyed because I want to watch Happy Days, and she's just yakety-yak like they do. And finally she said, is your mom there? I said, no, my mom's not home. And she goes, what do you mean your mom's not home? I said, she's at the tavern. The phone number is 282-4440. If you call there, this guy's going to answer the phone. Just ask for Darla. You don't have to say Johnson, Grandma. You just have to ask for Darla. They'll go get her. It's going to take a little bit. She's going to come to the phone. She's going to tell you she's going to have one more pitcher of beer, and she'll be home. You know, and she said, sweetie, give me that number again. And I gave it to her, and she says, this is what I want you to do. When your show's over, I want you to turn off the lights and go to bed and be ready to go to school in the morning. And I said, all right. And that was just, I didn't realize that, you know, whatever I was, 7 or 8 years old, I just thought that was a normal life. You know what I mean? Today, I would never do that to my kid. But back then, that was just the way it was. And, you know, and I'm laying there, and I'm watching Laverne and Shirley, and all of a sudden, I hear this rapping at the door, and I panic, and I crawl underneath the table because I didn't know who it was. And then they're beating on the window, and I'm starting to get really scared. And, you know, and I was just praying that it would go away. And all of a sudden, I hear this, Jason, it's Grandma, open the door. Man, that ease and comfort. You know, that feeling you get inside where it's just like, yeah, Grandma's here. You know what I mean? And I opened up that door, and she looked like she was crying, and she looked like she was mad, and she looked like she was going to kill somebody, and then she looked like she was going to love on me for the rest of my life. And she said, hey, just grab some stuff. you don't live here anymore. You live at my house. And I thought, yeah, I didn't ask, hey, did you talk to my mom? You know what I mean? I just went and got my stuff, whatever I wanted. And I took it over to her house. And, you know, I get to her house and that's like hitting a jackpot, because at my grandma's house, there was Rice Krispie treats. There was homemade popsicles in the freezer. There was cookies. There was nobody telling me I couldn't eat this. Nobody. It was just great to be there all the time. And I was going there to live. So I ran in that front door and I'm headed to the kitchen to get them Rice Krispie treats. And as I'm running through the front room, I hear this, hey, and I turn around. My grandpa's sitting there in his chair. He goes, what are you doing here? I said, I live here now. You know what I mean? Yeah. But here's the amazing thing. He didn't look over to my grandma and say, what are you thinking? He didn't ask anything like that. He just looked at me and said, yes, you do, buddy. Come here and give me a hug. And I crawled up in that guy's lap and I slept on his lap for the next 5 to 6 years. You know what I mean? Because I felt safe. Found out later, my grandma didn't run to buy him. You know what I mean? She did. My grandma wasn't that way. My grandma was a good Christian lady and she did what she did. You know what I mean? She was only like 5'3", but she controlled the flow of the family. You know, there was no, I didn't see a lot of bickering. You know what I mean? But he didn't ask. He just loved me. You know, and let me tell you something. I wasn't a good kid. I mean, I was a good kid. I mean, I robbed a Kool-Aid stand once, and I tied the kid up to the clothesline pole, and I got called into dinner, and the police came, and, you know, and that's the only time I heard my grandma swear at my grandpa. You know what I mean? We're out there, and they're untying this kid from the clothesline pole, and my grandpa starts laughing, and my grandma goes, what the hell are you laughing at? He goes, you just can't make this up. You know what I mean? And he'd go to the Elks and tell everybody what I did. But, you know, my grandpa, he didn't know what to do with me. You know, he had this 8-year-old kid. He was retired, and we spent a lot of time just staring at each other. You know what I mean? Like a first date. He would just rub his face like this in his head. And he'd look at me and he'd say, oh, what the hell? Just get in the truck. You know what I mean? We'd go drive around all day. You know what I mean? Because he didn't know what to do. You know what I mean? And I'd look at him and thinking, man, that's my best friend. You know what I mean? Because he loved me. And I didn't have no fear when I was around that guy. You know, when I was going into the sixth grade, he bought me this BMX bicycle. And it was one of those ones that had handbrakes. You know, it was when they came out. And, man, I was so excited. Before I even rode it, I took it on the back porch, and I moved the handlebars forward, and I put the seat down, and I started taking the brakes off. And I remember my grandpa came out, and he's looking at me, and he goes, hey, bud, what are you doing? I said, well, I'm fixing my bike up. He goes, yeah, what are you doing? I said, well, I lowered the seat and I moved the handlebars forward and now I'm taking the brakes off. And he says, well, how are you going to stop? And man, I remember looking at it. I never thought about that. You know what I mean? I walked around it and looked at it a little bit. And I said, well, here's what I think I'm going to do. I'm going to drag my foot on the back tire until it slows down. And when it slows down enough, I'll just jump off. You know what I mean? And I remember him going like this, and he looked at me and he said, well, when you crash, land on your head because you have nothing up there to hurt. And he walked off. You know what I mean? And I thought to myself, what the heck? That guy don't know anything. You know what I mean? Well, he did. And so the next day, where I grew up, we lived on the streets called 51st and Woodward. And everybody parked in the street. And then there was a grass strip, and there was a sidewalk, and then there's about 15 to 20 concrete stairs going up to my house. Or the front porch, and then there's a little sidewalk, and then a wood front porch. And I'm bringing my bike around, and one of my buddies says, hey, I bet you can't ride that bike down them stairs. I said, oh, yeah, I can, you know. And so I took it up on the porch because I was going to be a little bit better. And you're right. When you get to the about with them concrete stairs, that bike was out of control. You know, and I couldn't get my feet off the pedals. And sure enough, I smacked my head into my grandma's car and split my head wide open on her mirror. And, you know, at that moment in time, the only gifts I have in my life are run and cry. You know what I mean? So I started crying. And, you know, my grandma came out and she's not happy. She's asking questions so fast that I can't answer. Like, what are you thinking? What's going on? You know, and I'm like, I don't know. You know what I mean? And I remember standing at the kitchen counter while she's washing my head up. And she looked at me and she said, Jason, seriously, what were you thinking? I was like, well, grandma, I just didn't think I was going to go that far. You know what I mean? I didn't really think it out. And she just looked at me like I was an idiot. But then she yells at my grandpa, who my grandpa hadn't even got out of his chair. You know what I mean? He was still watching the news. It was like a typical Tuesday for him. You know what I mean? It didn't even faze him. And my grandma says, Gerald, you need to take him to the hospital. He's going to need stitches. And, you know, he got up kind of frustrated and he grabs his keys. And as we're walking down the stairs, he goes, boy, it's a good thing you took them brakes off, huh? And I said, yeah, but I landed on my head. You know what I mean? And we laughed. And that's how my relationship with my grandpa always was. My grandpa's the kind of guy, if you dropped a dollar on the ground, he'd spend $5 to get it back to you if he knew it was yours. He was just a good person. You know what I mean? I would get in trouble and I'd get an MIP, or I'd tie somebody up to the clothesline pole, or I would throw apples at moving cars, and you know what? And he would just be there. He would show up and tell me, boy, that's not a good idea. And as I got older and I started appearing in front of judges, if I didn't show up, he would go and tell the judge where I lived, where I worked, and how much money I make. He was just that kind of guy. You know what I mean? I was like, man, his favorite line to me is, laws are made for everybody. Whatever. You know what I mean? But that's how our life was. It was just back and forth, back and forth. You know, my grandma on the head, man, my grandma's that kind of lady that loved me no matter what. She's the kind of lady that I hope people in here have somebody in their life that loves them. You know what I mean? I mean, she loved me in a way that she never saw. She never put me down. You know, I was the kind of kid that I remember I was in school, maybe going into fifth or sixth grade, and I had gotten in trouble every day for like 2 or 3 weeks. And finally, they called us all into the office after school one day. And I get in this office, and there's like a counselor and a principal and a couple other teachers or something like that sitting on this side of the table. My grandma's sitting over here, and they told me to sit right here. And they started going over everything I'd done the last 3 weeks. You know, all the stuff I'd done to everybody and everything, and what they thought of this and what they thought of that. And I remember my grandma had that look on her face that she had when she was standing at that door. Like she was disappointed, but she was scared, but she was sad. You know, and she didn't argue with them. She listened to everything they said. And when they got done, she asked if she could say something. And they said yes. And she said, you know, I'm not going to tell you Jason didn't do any of those things. He lives at my house. You know what I mean? I guarantee you he probably did those things. But can I tell you some of the good things about him? She said he's a good kid. And the reason I know he's a good kid and he has a good heart and there's a good person inside there is because every day on his way to school, he runs down to Mrs. Harrington's house and throws her newspaper up on the front porch so she doesn't have to walk down the stairs. And the young man, Shane, at the store, that's simple-minded. Every time I see Shane at church or I see him someplace, the first thing he asks is, where's Jason? Because when Jason's around, nobody picks on him, and Jason always picks him first for sports. So I know there's a good kid inside of there. It's our responsibility to figure out how to tap into that. And, you know, I didn't get put in a different class, and I stayed in that school, and I had the best year of my life in school because people looked at me different. My grandma was that. She was the person that always saw the better in me. I remember being in church, and this is, I've never seen so many churches on the way here. You guys have churches like we have 7-Elevens. You know what I mean? I mean, it's kind of out of whack, but I'm not judging. But I grew up in a Baptist church, and my grandma, every Sunday, she sat in the fifth row on the left-hand side. That's where she was, and I was that little kid in the back, and it wasn't back then. They didn't have little flashers that went on the thing. They didn't have little pagers to tell you. The deacon had to walk down and get grandma, tap her on the shoulder and say, you need to come get Jason. And this happened like 6 or 7 times in a row. You know, and what happened is it wasn't really my fault. What happened, my grandpa took me to the rodeo the night before for the 4th of July. And man, I just was wound up by the time I got to church on Sunday. And so I ended up in this office with this, I guess he's a Sunday school superintendent. And I'm sitting in there and waiting for my grandma to come get me. And my grandma comes in the door and she goes, let's go. And I said, all right. So I get up. She's like mad. You know, I figured no McDonald's for me. And as I'm getting up, this guy Scott says to her, she says, well, Hazel, I don't think Jason should come back to church until he can learn to use some self-control. And my grandma spun around and she said, listen to me. With the enthusiasm he has for life and the heart he has inside of him, he might just end up being the next pastor of this church. And I was like, whoa, whoa, whoa. I don't want to be a pastor, Grandma. I want to be a rodeo clown. You know what I mean? And she just looked at me and said, that's cute. Get in the car. And so we get in the car. And, you know, and this is how my grandma was. When we're in the car, she said, you want to be a rodeo clown? I said, yeah. She goes, well, you just be the best rodeo clown you can be. And that's how our life was, man. She just loved me no matter what. And made it safe for me. Gave me a safe place to live. You know, when I was going into sixth grade is when I started drinking alcohol. And, you know, my first experience with alcohol wasn't like some of you guys. Some people say you take a feeling. Well, oh. I went over to a friend's house to sleep in the backyard with two other guys. And his mom was going to go bowling. She said, I left $10 on the counter. We ordered pizza. And when the pizza gets here, make sure you pay him the money and stay in the yard. And don't get in any trouble. And I was like, oh, that's pretty easy. So there's three of us. And the pizza comes, and my friend Leif says, pizza tastes better with beer. I had never had it. And I said, yes, it does. He went downstairs, and he brought up this case of Lucky Lager beer. And, yeah. nothing good going there for me, baby. You know what I mean? I used to say I drank one or two, but Leif heard my talk and he says, no, you drank six, which means I thought I got food poisoning. Maybe I just had alcohol poisoning. But I remember looking at those guys after I drank those beers saying, man, I got food poisoning and I'm going home. And I went home on my bike with no brakes. And I go in my house and when I get sick at my grandma's house, man, she puts a blanket or a towel on the pillow. She puts a bowl by the bed. She puts the night lights on. She opens up all the doors. She turns the fan on. I mean, it was good being sick there. Nobody came in and saw me that night. Nothing. Crickets. And I was sick all night. And I finally fell asleep. And the next thing I know, my grandpa's at the end of my bed telling me to get up. I got to go to work. I'm like, man, I don't have a job. I'm in the sixth grade and I really don't feel well. You know what I mean? He said, if you're going to drink like a big boy, you're going to work like a big boy. Now get out of bed. And I was like, oh, man, he's serious. So as we're going out the door, my grandma hands me an egg salad sandwich and a warm thermos of milk and tells me, have a great day. And we went over and we picked up Leif and Sean and we went and picked strawberries. Yeah, I made 27 cents. And this has been like 40 years. I remember that. You know what I mean? And I remember sitting in that field, looking over my grandpa sitting on the tailgate of his truck, drinking his coffee, reading his paper, laughing, and I'm getting sick picking strawberries, It took me a long time to even be around a strawberry. But I remember sitting there with my buddies, and I said, man, I'm not drinking no more. And they're like, you don't like the alcohol? I said, no, I just don't want to work. You know what I mean? I'm not cut up for this. So I went cold turkey, no AA, no treatment, no nothing. Done. Squat until I got to high school. And this is when I started doing step work. This is when I realized that my alcoholism kicked in. Because what happened was is on Mondays, I start saving my lunch money so I could buy booze on Thursdays. You know what I mean? So Monday, I was saving money. Tuesday, I was saving lunch money. Wednesday, we were trying to figure out who we were going to have go buy it. Thursday, we got it. Friday, we drank. Saturday, we drank. Sunday, we went to church and asked for our forgiveness. And then we did it all over again. And that's how my high school career was. I was pretty good at sports. I did all right. So I would just go play sports during the week. Drink on the weekends. And that's just how my life was. And you know, and I got some MIPs because, you know, when you invest in a keg and somebody says police, you don't run. You know what I mean? I got $30 invested in this thing. I'm going to stay. Well, I got an MIP there. And one time I ran with a tap, not knowing what it was. So I got another MIP there. But those are details. All they're doing is taking my license away. And I don't drive anyway. You know what I mean? So it wasn't like that big of a deal. And those were the consequences. And every time I got in trouble, my grandma would come get me, take me to church. They'd pray for me and we'd try it again the next weekend. And, you know, it was no big quant. I mean, when you got an MIP back then, they just took you home. You know what I mean? When I robbed the Kool-Aid stand with the BB gun, there was no Measure 11. There was no fines or anything. I was like, he just needs to stay away from the neighbors. And that's kind of how it was. And so when I was getting these things, there was no big consequences. My senior year in 1989, this is hearsay. They say I stole the motorcycle, but I borrowed it, you know, I got in a high speed chase and I crashed and I ended up in a hospital and I just remember coming to and an officer being at the end of my bed one time and coming to and another officer and then they were reading me my rights and talking to me about the accident and I remember and asked them how do you know it was me? They said, well, we saw people witness you stealing the motorcycle and then you were at the crash site. And so really not much negotiation there. I just took the deal But what happened was, when I was in that hospital, I had got revived a couple of times, and I got to a point where when I woke up this one time, I asked the nurse, I said, what happened? She said, you were in a drunk driving accident, and you're going to have a 1 out of 6 chance of saving your leg and a 3 out of 5 chance of living. And I said, what's that mean? She says, you're probably going to live, but you're going to lose your left leg from the knee down. And I just thought, man, that sucks. And I remember sitting in that hospital telling myself, man, I'm not drinking alcohol anymore, ever again. That's the problem. And I didn't drink for 2 or 3 weeks after I got out of the hospital. But after 2 or 3 weeks, that anxiety and that fear and that scaredness came in. And the only solution I had was to drink. And let me tell you, I drank as much as I possibly could. It got to the point where I was staying, I don't know if anybody here, where you stay in houses where there's an extension cord from the neighbors, or you have a hose that you can go get water in a bucket and you can put it in the toilet. And I mean, candlelight isn't all that bad. And I just kept lowering my standards to keep up with my quality of life. You know what I mean? And I would just drink. And I used everybody I could, and I used every situation. And every once in a while, some of my uncles would come by and tell me, hey, you need to call your grandma because she's calling all of us, asking, has anybody seen Jason? Anybody know where Jason is? Is Jason alive? Can somebody go find Jason? And you just need to call her so she'll leave us alone. You know, and so I would call my grandma and I'd tell her, I'm going to come over tomorrow, Grandma. And I meant it with all my heart. You know what I mean? But I'm an alcoholic. I'm not a bad person. I'm an alcoholic. And what I do is I drink. And that's all I know how to do. And November or December 4th, 1997, I was at a house and I'd been on a good, pretty good run. And one of my uncles, Uncle Leroy, he's like actually a cousin to my mom, but shows up at my house where I was at and he says, hey, you need to get up to the hospital. Your grandma's been on life support. They took her off of it. You need to get up there. And I said, I don't want to go. He said, you're going to go. You know, and I got in his truck and he gave me a pint of booze. He said, drink this. You'll be all right. You know, and I remember getting to that hospital, Portland Adventist, and walking upstairs. And you know, when the ICU where all the family sits out here and there's everybody can go on two or three at a time, all my cousins, all my aunts, all my uncles were there. And I didn't look anybody in the eye because at that point in time, I knew I was a piece of crap and I wasn't going to amount to anything. And I was good with that. I didn't need to look at anybody then to validate I was not a good person. You know what I mean? Because all I knew how to do was drink. And I remember sitting on this chair, and I'd only seen my grandpa cry once in my whole life. And when he came out of my grandma's room, he was crying. You know, and he walked over, and he didn't even say anything to me. And he walked down the hall, started talking to somebody. And one of my aunts came out to me, and she said, you know, and she wasn't really happy. She said, I'm going to tell you, you need to go in there, and you need to say goodbye to your grandma. Because, you know, for the last 3 or 4 days, when she comes to, the first thing she asks, has anybody seen Jason? Has Jason been here yet? And it's killing us. You know, and that's not a good pep talk to give a guy. And so I go in there, and my Uncle Gary's there, and my Uncle Leroy's there, and one of my other aunts. And I remember I grabbed my grandma's hand. I said, Grandma, I'm here. And she just sat right up and opened her eyes and started talking to me. You know, and people were all looking in the door and everything. And she just, you know, you just do what you have to do. You know, I told her I loved her and I missed her, and I didn't realize she was this sick. And she told me that she missed me, and she was so proud of what I was doing with my life. And I wasn't even doing anything. You know what I mean? And I told Grandma, I said, I got to go. I'll come back tomorrow and see you. And she said, you promise? I said, yes. You know, and as I was leaving, I could hear her tell my Uncle Gary, you know, he's a good kid. He's a good person inside of there. He's going to do something with his life. And I just thought, no, I'm not. And I just left. You know what I mean? I told my Uncle Leroy, I'll just walk home. You know, and I did what I had to do. You know, I did what you do when you're at that situation. I just drink. For the next 3 or 4 weeks, man, it was bad. But, you know, and what really got bad is 3 or 4 days later, one of my uncles, Dale, comes to me and he says, hey, your grandma passed and the funeral's on Wednesday. I'll come get you. I said, all right. That Wednesday came and I sat in my closet when he was beating on the door and I didn't come out. I just couldn't. You know what I mean? I remember sitting in there with a bottle of Goldschlager drinking because I didn't know what to do. You know, and I could hear him out there yelling, Jason, this is going to haunt you for the rest of your life. You know, you need to do this for your grandma. Your grandma would want you to be there. And I wanted so bad to come out of that closet, but I couldn't, so I just drank. You know, and I missed the whole funeral. Yeah, I didn't go over really good with the rest of my family. So, this is what happens. About 3 weeks of this, of drinking, I get to the point where alcohol is not really working. I have that anxiety, that fear, and nothing's going away. And so I call my Uncle Gary, it's on Sunday morning. I said, hey, are you going to church today? He said, yes, I am. I said, can I meet you there? He said, yes, you can. Well, I knew he wouldn't beat me up in church. You know what I mean? I knew I had a butt whooping coming. You know, because he's like my older brother. He's only 8 years older than me. And my mom's like 10 years older than him and my aunts, you know. So we were closer together. We were more like brothers. And so I knew I had a butt whooping coming. But I knew he wasn't going to do it there. So I go to this church and I'd been sleeping in underneath a trampoline in the backyards and some stuff and some bushes. So I wasn't really looking too clean. I hadn't had anything in my body that was helping me medicate for a while. And I was just shaking and I was scared. And I went down and they sat in the fifth row right where my grandma sits. And I'm sitting there and they start singing How Great Thou Art, that song. You know what I mean? And that kind of got me. All of a sudden they sing Amazing Grace. And I got caught up in the moment. And I looked at my uncle. I said, man, I think I got a drinking problem. And the whole church went quiet. The song was over, Gary told me later. But he says, he looked at me and he says, you think? I was like, well, I might have a drug problem, too, if it makes you feel better about yourself. And he said, well, this is what we're going to do. You're going to come over to my house as soon as this is over. You're going to shower because you stink. We're going to wash your clothes, and we're going to talk about what we're going to do. And I was like, all right, can we get something to eat? And he just looked at me, right? And so I go over to his house, and as soon as we get there, my Aunt Linda says, man, give me those clothes. Get in the shower. I shower. I come out, and there's a phone book on the counter. He goes, you're going to go to treatment. I said, what's treatment? He said, this is not up for negotiation. Look up hospitals and start calling treatment centers. So it's Sunday. I didn't think anybody would answer. So the first hospital was this Portland Adventist. I called it. They answered like on the third ring. I explained to them that my uncle thinks I have a drinking problem. And I need to do something about it. And so they tapped me over to this other guy. And we did this little talk, blah, 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 blah. And we came up with this agreement that I could come there the next morning at 8 a.m. And we'd do an assessment and see if I was able to go to treatment. And so I got off the phone. I told my uncle, hey, 8 a.m. at 60th and Belmont. I said, just give me $20 and I'll see you there in the morning. He said, oh, no, you're staying here. I was like, oh, man. He says it's a leather couch to this day. I think it's plastic. But I laid on his couch all night. And his dog's licking me all night. And it's just miserable. And I'm tossing and turning. And I hadn't had any. You know when you're sweating from the inside out. You ache. Your knees ache. Your ankles ache. You're just hating it. And it's just miserable. Try to be on a plastic couch with a dog licking you all night. It just keeps getting worse. You know what I mean? The next morning I get up. Well, I was up. They get up. And my uncle tells me I need to take a shower because I look like crap and I smell again. And so I go to take a shower. When I get out, he goes to get in the shower. My aunt's gone. And I'm thinking, hey, he has a liquor cabinet. And man, I felt better already. You know what I mean? And I went to his liquor cabinet. Sure enough, he had some Bacardi 151. I went and got a pop can out of the refrigerator, dumped it out, poured 151 in there, and I started drinking it. And man, I was ready to go to treatment. I don't know what treatment is, but I'm in. You know what I mean? We get in the car and we're driving and I'm drinking this pop can, just talking away. And he goes, man, I smell booze. I said, well, it ain't me. I'm going to treatment. You know what I mean? Yeah. How many times somebody said that to me lately? You know what I mean? But I'm still pretty good at what I'm doing. So when we get to the hospital or this office building, the first thing I do is I go into the bathroom. I pull up the garbage can. I put my can underneath the bag so nobody would know, which was my biggest mistake because it gave my uncle time to meet with this guy, Tim, to make a plan what they were going to do with me. That's what I thought. And so I'm sitting in there and Tim, this guy, the treatment guy, calls me in. He says, I need to ask you some questions and we need to go over some stuff. And so we go in there. My uncle goes with me because he's way more enthused about my treatment than I am. And they asked me if I had insurance. I said, no. He said, my uncle said, I'll pay for it and his grandpa will pay for it. Whatever it costs, we'll take care of it. I thought that was stupid. You could have just gave me the money and I could have got a job and rented an apartment and party for a few weeks. So we got that part out. And then he asked me, I'm going to ask you some questions. You need to be honest. He asked questions that I said no to everyone. And then he got to some that were kind of tricky, like, have you ever hid your alcohol use from your family and friends or your employer? And I was like, man, I kind of did that on the way over. No. You know what I mean? Have you ever lied about your alcohol use or drug use to your family, your friends, and employer? I looked at my uncle again and said, no. And then I knew they were onto something because I had Noah like 17. And they were just looking and giving me this weird look. So I knew I was going to have to answer yes to something. So they said, have you ever drank or used drugs before an important engagement or meeting? I looked at them. I thought, this is pretty important to these two. So I said yes. And I got a wristband. I was in treatment just like that. You know what I mean? Didn't know what treatment was, but I got this shot in the behind. I got put in a room. It was warm. There was a pillow. It was December 29th. This guy kept coming in and telling me, hey, you need to go to group. I finally had to tell him I'm not in group. I'm in treatment. I found out that's the same thing. So I'm in this group, and they start talking about Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, and I need to tell you, I told you at the very beginning, my mom and dad got divorced when I was 3 years old. When I was 27 years old, my dad came, called up my mom, and he wanted to pay back all the back child support that he owed. And I went there to get my half of the money, which is another thing I had to pay back. It wasn't my money, it was my mom's money. I got the wrong sponsors, what really happened here. But he's very into giving people their money back. But I went there, and I seen this guy, and I said hi. I took my half of the money, and I left. 3 years later, I'm in this treatment facility, and they start talking about Alcoholics Anonymous. And when I was in the treatment, it was Portland Adventist, so they have no caffeine, no sugar, and no women. Very big, important things in my life, which I really didn't have a life, but they were important things to me. And they said, we're going to go to this AA meeting. This man's going to pick us up, and there's caffeine, sugar, and there's women. I said, cool, I got to go. They got to go ask. So I went to Tim, and I said, Tim, can I go to treatment or the AA? I'll go to every group on time. I'll pray. I'll write that four-step thing you want me to do. I'll participate. I won't be late. I mean, I just gave him everything I had. He said, yeah, you can go. You just need to fill your name out on this piece of paper. I was like, damn, I overcommitted. You know what I mean? I should have just asked. So needless to say, I get in this van, and I'm driving in this van, and I'm praying to God that I don't know anybody. And we get in this meeting, and sure enough, there's sugar, there's caffeine, and there's women. So I'm trying to hide my wristband. I'm looking at everybody and winking, and they're looking at me like you're a moron. And I probably was. And I look back, and I see this guy, and I looked at these guys. I go, hey, I think that's my dad. They said, that's your dad. I said, well, I've only seen him one time in like 26 years, but I think that's him. They said, well, you got to go talk to him. I said, well, let's just focus on the caffeine, the sugar, and the women. We'll deal with that after the meeting. Well, they have a break. I don't go to meetings with breaks anymore. But they have a break. And so we go up to this guy, and this guy's standing here, and this other guy, Mike, standing next to him. I walked up to him, and I said, hey, do you know who I am? He said, no. I said, I think you're my dad. And he said, Jason? And I said, yeah. And he hugged me, and Alcoholics Anonymous changed for me right there. You know, it was like a burning bush. You know what I mean? It's like, wow. You know what I mean? I think 4 or 5 of us stayed sober in treatment just because of that. We're like, how'd that happen? You know, he asked me, can I come visit you? I was like, yeah, the only people coming are my mom and my uncle. And he's way too enthused with my sobriety. I need all the friends I can get. Well, he showed up. I forgot to tell my mom, and we were the talk of the treatment center for 2 weeks. But that's a whole nother story. But what that guy did, he was doing a night step, and he saved my life. You know what I mean? Because when we got out, I got out of treatment, he started taking me to all these meetings. He was very active, and he's still active in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, and he has a better relationship with my daughter and my wife than I do, but we have a relationship, you know what I mean? And I owe my life to that guy because he's one of those guys that showed me a little bit of grace. And, man, life just got great. I met a woman in AA. I married her. She got pregnant like that. Kind of got bait and switched, you know what I mean? She told me, I can't get pregnant. 30 days later, we're pregnant. And I'm like, damn, I got to get a job, stay sober. It's just getting bad, you know what I mean? But I did her. You know, I did it for 7 years. You know, I met John at 3 years. I thought AA was going pretty good. But here's what happened. And this is what you need to listen to, is that about 8 years of sobriety, I started thinking, man, if it wasn't for that amazing grace and how great they were, I wouldn't be an alcoholic. Maybe I'm not out. Man, you people are like, you know, like some people say, you sound like Charlie Brown. Wah, 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 wah. It's the same thing over and over. I'm not an alcoholic. So I started taking unprincipled actions in Alcoholics Anonymous. I started doing things in the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous that were on these fake fourth and fifth steps I thought I did. You know, I was lying, cheating, stealing, and I was doing some other stuff. And, you know, I got pretty good at some of the stuff I was doing. Good enough that I bought this car and I took it to this place called Les Schwab. And they put some wheels and tires on it. And as I'm pulling out of this place, the wheel falls off and I crash. And I was like, dang, that sucks. Well, they rented me this Chrysler 300. And it kind of like, it's like a Mercedes or like a Rolls Royce looking thing. I was like, man, I have arrived. You know what I mean? This is a pretty good car. So I get in this car and I go do what I've been doing for the last 2 years. I pick up this substantial amount of something. That's what the police report says. So I pick this stuff up and I'm driving down the street. And sure enough, you know, these cops swarm the car. You know, and I mean, it's not like one or two cops. I'm talking like they came from every direction. And so I did what every good alcoholic does. I just kind of sat there and act like I didn't know what was going on. I took this 157 grams of something and I put it underneath the front seat because it was a guy before me and it was a rental car. You know what I mean? I have valid driver's license, proof of insurance, and this is just a big mistake. So it takes them 4, 5, 6, maybe 10 minutes to get everything up. There's some people talking. They're looking in the window. They're looking at me and I'm looking at them and I'm trying to act like I'm calling somebody from church. And, you know, it's just, you know, I'm not talking to anybody on the phone. And all of a sudden, the officer walks up and I roll down the window and he says, Jason, can you shut the car off and step up on the curb? That's not a good sign right there. They didn't even ask me for my ID. You know what I mean? So I said, well, yeah, I could do that. So I shut the car up and I opened up that door. And as I'm getting out of here, this, I look down and the seat's going back all by itself. Yeah, it's not really funny to this day. And it's been like 10 years. You know what I mean? And you can't yell time out and you can't yell do over. So there's my 157 grams of mess sitting in the dead center in the middle of the floor and the seat's way back. It's one of those automatic seats. I don't get in cars like that anymore. I mean, I'm sober. I still don't do it. You know what I mean? It's just odd. And, you know, so I did what every good drug dealer does. I shut the door and hope they didn't see it. And needless to say, I got charged with commercial delivery, commercial possession, racketeering, intimidation of a federal witness, and a gun charge. Sober. You know, and I remember sitting in the back of this car thinking, I wonder if anybody's going to notice. You know what I mean? Or how am I going to get out of this? Or, you know, I was trying to make up a story. And I went to this one place and I went to a booking cell because of 9/11. You have to go through this big process. And I'm sitting in this jail cell with like 20 people, 30 people. It kind of looks like some of you guys. And I'm not judging, but you do. And so we're watching the news, the 10 o'clock news. And it goes, da-da-da-da, Meth Watch, 2007. Jason Johnson. And I was like, holy, is my driver's license picture, a bag of dope, a gun, some money. I'm thinking, holy crap, My family saw that. You know what I mean? I became a celebrity in my jail cell block just like that. But you know what I mean? It was like, I wasn't ready for that. That was nowhere on my plans, you know. And when I got out, man, I had guilt and shame. And I did what the only thing I know how to do at that time, I put a needle in my arm and I started running. You know what I mean? And I burned it down. My wife divorced me, which was a great call on her behalf. I had a 7-year-old daughter at that time. I mean, I got to the point when I started drinking and using that I was just robbing and stealing everybody. You know what I mean? Because I was too embarrassed, too ashamed, and too scared to admit it. I would go to court, they'd give me a different date. They'd give a court, they'd give me a different date. They'd give a court. And at this time, I was supposed to be going to treatment. I wasn't going to treatment. And finally, the judge said to me, Jason, if you don't go to treatment, you're going to go to prison for at least 6 to 7 years. And I said, well, all right, I'll go to treatment. She said, be back here in 2 weeks with a piece of paper. And I came back 2 weeks later, and I didn't have that piece of paper. And Judge Nelson said that'll be 48 months in prison. I remember looking at my attorney and said, 4 to 8 months ain't that bad. He said, not 4 to 8 months, that's 48 months. I was like, ooh, that's bad. You know what I mean? I got to get some sleep. Yeah, I wasn't ready for that. And then I had a couple of jailhouse lawyers that told me I could ask to get my affairs in order. They said, no, you leave today. And what happened is I got put into a cell block with a bunch of guys, and they gave me some possessions. And I don't know, they don't give you a rule book in Oregon. And so I got in some trouble. And so I went in front of us telling Robert, I went in front of this little board because I was in trouble for having other people's possessions, and they gave me my, it's kind of their fault. They asked me, do you have anything to say? And I was like, well, yeah, I got some stuff to say. And I explained to them, they don't give you a rule book. They don't know what they're doing and so forth. And the lady just said, hey, the sheriff's office has been running the jail system since the 1800s in the state of Oregon. We don't need your opinion. And I said, that's your effing problem. Well, that's 3 weeks in the hole. You know what I mean? And, no negotiation. Just boom, 3 weeks in the hole. But here's what happened. I got in that hole, and that's where I needed to be. Because I had this fear and this anxiety that I had, and that feeling of just failing in there. And what I did is I just got on my knees and I said, please help, thank you, amen. And I got back on that bed, and if I got 5 to 10 minutes of relief, I got back on my knees and I just said, thanks. And I started doing that. And I just started getting right with God. I just started to get right in God. Just doing whatever I can, little by little. And I finally got put into population, and you know, and I don't know about you, but when I'm running, I borrow money from everybody. If I know you, I owe you. That's my motto. Well, there's this guy, Randy's my best friend. And he, at this time, when I was running out there before I got put in my deep little jail thing, I call it a men's retreat. Not this kind of men's retreat. I guess I can't say that. It ain't no fun here. Churches, it works better like that. But, you know, before I got put on my men's retreat, I stole $3,000 from Randy. And at that time, Randy had 2 kids, and he had a daughter in college, 2 daughters in high school, and a boy with special needs. And he didn't have that money, but he loaned it to me. And, you know, and I told him I had to do something to pay my fines. And what I was doing, I just went to a video poker machine and tried to double it, and I blew it. You know what I mean? And I ran. And I never called Randy again, and he would call me, and he'd tell me stuff like he's praying for me, and that come back to Alcoholics Anonymous, and blah, blah, blah. And I just avoided him. Well, I got visitation, my first visitation, right? And I'm like, yeah, man, hopefully it's my attorney getting me out of here. And I go down there, and it's one of those rooms with the glass and the phones, and it's a little closet, and you're there for 30 minutes no matter what. And I walk in there, and shoo, Randy's there. You know what I mean? Good God. You know when you owe somebody money? It's never good when you owe somebody money and you're stuck in a closet with them for 30 minutes. You know what I mean? And I'm looking at him, and he's looking at me, and I just invited God to go with me. And I sat down and I said, you know what, Randy? Man, I made some mistakes. I apologize for what I did. I'm not that guy, I don't think, anymore. I'm trying to be better, and I'll pay you back that money. And he just said, Jason, stop. I'm not here to tell you, argue about the money. I'm here to tell you I love you. And we miss you. And my family came to me, and they gave me their Christmas money, and they would like to know what your daughter and your ex-wife would like for Christmas from you. We would like to purchase it for them. And I just sat there and cried. That's Alcoholics Anonymous. That's a guy that's working something that I'm not working. You know what I mean? And what that did is, Bill said, it gave me some hope. You know what I mean? It just gave me hope. And what happened is I went back to my cell, and I got into the big book, and I started reading with other guys. I started going to meetings, and in 3 months and 27 days of a 4-month sentence, some judges did some things in Alcoholics Anonymous for me. And I got released to serve my time in the community and got a suspended sentence. I got put into public. And the only restrictions I had was don't drink or use and get a job. Man, and I haven't drank or used, and I've got a job. You know what I mean? But what happened is I fell in love with Alcoholics Anonymous, and I went all in. And now I'm going to tell you what, there's points in my relationship, like with my, I remember my daughter, when she was born, we saved these quarters. You know, the quarters that have the states on the back. And there was a point when my wife would let me come over to see her when I was on the run, kind of, you know, getting ready to go. And I was at that 9-month period. And for me, this was one of the worst parts for me is I remember coming out of the shower and my wife having these buckets and she's going, "You stole your daughter's money." And I'm thinking, I know I stole my money. I can't believe I did that either. But the worst thing was, is my daughter's pulling on my wife's leg saying, "Please don't make my daddy leave. I let him borrow it." And when that happened, it ate me up inside and I just left and I ran. You know, and that relationship with that daughter was tough. You know what I mean? I just didn't know how to be a father, you know. And what happened is when I finally sobered back up and I got put back in I married my wife again and I got back in the family. But I still was that rugged father. And, you know, we have a sponsorship meeting once a month. I don't know if you guys do that. And every month we meet at somebody's house and we can talk about those things in Alcoholics that we can't talk about in Alcoholics Anonymous. We talk about, you know, sexual relationships. We talk about being a father. And I flat told him, "Hey, I don't know how to be a father." I said, "Every time my daughter's at my house, I want to kill her." And this one kid, Larry, who I can't stand, says to me, "I have a suggestion." I'm like, "Great." Larry's one of the Notigans. I think he's like the number one Notigan, to tell you the truth. And he tells me, he goes, "I'll tell you what, Jason, when we go to AA events, the first thing my kids ask is, Jason going to be there?" And the reason that is because when they see you, you hug them, you tell them you love them, you make sure they're entertaining, you make sure they're fed. So when you're having a problem with Bailey, why don't you treat her like you're babysitting my kids? I said, "That's the stupidest thing I ever heard." So I started doing it. And, you know, my daughter was 13 years old. She was having a slumber party. And there's like 7 or 8 little 13-year-olds in the room doing whatever they're doing. And I'm sleeping just fine. And my wife hits me on the shoulder. She says, "You need to go tell them to be quiet." I said, "I didn't invite them." She said, "Yeah, it didn't work like that." She hit me again. So I went in there and they're jumping around. And I yelled at them. I gave them everything I had. You know what I mean? And I told them, "You need to shut the light off, blah, blah, blah." And I slammed the door. And me and the dog go back, get in bed. And I'm laying there. I'm thinking, man, is that how you treat anybody's kids? Is that an example of Alcoholics Anonymous? Is that an example of the Big Book? So what I did is I got back up and I went back in there and I opened up that door and I turned on the light and they're all just sitting there looking at me. And I said, "Hey, you know what? We just need to turn the light down. You need to turn the TV down. And you need to act like you're going to sleep because you're making Julie really mad." Yeah. And I apologized. You know, but here's the thing. My daughter Cody, my daughter's best friend, said, "I told you guys he would come back and apologize." I damn near missed that. That's Alcoholics Anonymous. That's because I took some direction from somebody I don't like in my sponsorship line, which actually I do love. You know what I mean? I started doing those things, and I only got a few more minutes, but I want to talk a little bit about the ninth step with my grandma. You know what I mean? That's haunted me for a long time. I mean, I came in 97, went back out. I came back in 2007. And in all those years, I wrote letters. Talked to people. I've sat with Howard P. I've sat with a bunch of people that I love and respect. You know, I've done all these suggestions. I've done everything I could, but I just, when I drive, I have to drive by that cemetery twice a week. And when I drive by there, sometimes it just eats me up inside. You know what I mean? I can't believe I did that. But then I remember I hear the voice that says, "I'm an alcoholic. That's why I did it. I'm not a bad person. I'm an alcoholic." And I've been fighting that. And, you know, finally about a year and a half ago, a guy named Jimmy Jack Bailey sent me this thing on Facebook, and it was a story about a kid, and I don't know if this is what his intentions was, but this is what it was. There's this little boy, he's like 4 or 5 years old. His sisters are born, his dad starts paying attention to them, and so he gets mad, and he finds out he knows his dad really likes football, so he asks his parents, "Can I play football?" And they sign him up for football. And right away he realizes it's a big mistake because he's not very athletic. He don't like to run, he's slow, people hit him, he doesn't catch, he doesn't throw, but he just stays in there because after every game and after every practice, his dad finds him and hugs him, tells him he loves him and how proud he is of him. You know what I mean? It just goes like that. It goes all the way up through high school. Just keeps playing. Kid gets to high school and it's his senior year and his team's going to the state championship. And a couple weeks before the big game, a coach calls him over at practice. He says, "Son, I need to talk to you." He said, "Your dad had a heart attack today and passed." And the young man hits his knees and he starts crying. And, you know, he sits there for a little bit and everybody gathers around. He gets up. He asks the coach, he goes, "You think I could go home a little early today?" And the coach is like, "What? Go home. Take care of your family. Take care of your dad. Do whatever. This is just a game. This is just a sport. Do whatever you got to do." So the kid goes and they end up dedicating the season to his dad. They write papers and an article about his dad in the school and all that. The big game comes and the kid doesn't show up. And it's like the third or fourth quarter. This team's losing pretty bad. And sure enough, it's like a Rudy moment. Here comes the kid running out to the field. He runs up to the coach and asks him if he can play. The coach says no and kind of ignores him. Kid keeps on him. Finally, the coach says, "Go in there." Whoops. George's. He goes in there, and sure enough, he intercepts the ball the first play and runs it back for a touchdown. The coach is scratching his head and tells him to stay in there, and the kid's doing phenomenal. He gets down to the last play of the game. The other team's up by 4 or 5 points. They're getting ready to punt the ball. Their best player's going to have to run it back to win the thing. There's no time left. And they hike the ball, and the kid blocks the punt and runs it in for a touchdown. And it is a Rudy moment. You know, it's dizzying. They run in there, and they grab him, and they carry him off, and everybody's excited. And that night, the young man's in the locker room, and everybody's gone. The coach walks out and says, "Take your time, son." So the kid says, "Thanks." And as the coach turns around, he turns back around, and he says, "Hey, I need to ask you something." He goes, "You know, you're the worst athlete I've ever coached. You know what I mean? You can't catch. You can't throw. You're the slowest person. What happened out there?" He says, "I just don't get it." And the young man stood up and he said, "Coach, I don't know if you know this, but after every single game I ever in, even the games that you didn't play me for 5 or 6 games in a row, or the games where I lost the game for us because I dropped the ball, after every one of those games, my dad would come find me and he'd hug me and whisper in my ear that he loved me and tell me how proud he was of me." And the coach said, and the coach is trying not to cry. He said, "Man, that's a good man." And the young man says, "But coach, you don't know this. My dad was blind. And tonight's the first night he ever really got to see me play." And just like that, I got this feeling of ease, like when my grandma came and got me at my door. And I realized that every time I stand at a podium of Alcoholics Anonymous, or I'm in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, I say, "My name is Jason Johnson, I'm an alcoholic." My grandma sees that. Every time I walk into a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous or one of my home group, and I see somebody new and I walk up to them and say, "Hey, my name is Jason, I haven't seen you here before, can I sit by you?" My grandma sees that. So I know that's being relieved. You know, and I know because of what you folks have done for me and the God you've given me. Today, my prayer is every morning I get on my knees, I say, "My dear friend, if you see fit and it be thy will, I sure appreciate it if I could stay in Alcoholics Anonymous just one more day." And I get up and I try to be the best member of Alcoholics Anonymous I can. And you've given me a relationship with God. And you built this thing so that I know that when I pass and I go to that big meeting in the sky, my grandparents are going to be out in the parking lot waiting for me. I can see it already. You know, my grandpa's going to be leaning against the truck, just mad, thinking I'm late. You know what I mean? And he's going to see me and he's going to start waving. He usually waves with one finger because he doesn't think I ever know where I'm going. And I'm going to walk up to that man and he's probably going to itch his head and look at me, and I'm going to look at him like when I was a little kid. He's probably going to say something like, "I didn't think you were going to make it." You know, but I'm going to hug him and I'm going to tell him I love him and I'm going to thank him for giving me a safe place to live. But my grandma, if I close my eyes, I can smell her perfume. I know what she's going to do. She's going to be having her hands in the air, and she's going to be dancing. And she's probably going to be praising Jesus and thanking God and throwing a couple "I told you so's" to my grandpa. But you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to hug that lady. And she's going to tell me she's loving, and she's going to tell me she's proud of me. And I'm going to be able to look at her in the eye and say, "Grandma, it's the damnedest thing." Some drunk people in Alcoholics Anonymous, the ones that people said had no hope, no value, no meaning, no purpose, those people that people said need to be locked up and put away, those people have found a solution and they shared it with me. And then some of those folks, Grandma, showed me a little bit of grace. And in doing that, they introduced me to that guy inside of here that only you knew existed. So if you're sitting in here tonight and somebody's telling you you have no value, no meaning, or no purpose, or no worth, do me a favor and do Alcoholics Anonymous a favor and do yourself a favor. Look them in the eye and tell them to go screw themselves. You know what I mean? Because everybody's life, you've taught me, no matter what color, race, whatever it is, everybody's life has meaning, everybody's life has a value, and everybody's life has a purpose. We are gifted with that. We have that. We've been given that gift. You know, I was walking through the airport the other day, and I was at a conference in Texas, and I was supposed to be going to L.A. and then going home, and the plane got detoured to Phoenix. I didn't know you could do that. And then they canceled my flight, and so I'm pissed off, right? You know, my phone's dead, and I'm walking through this airport because we have to go stay at a hotel for the night, and this Delta system went down or some stupid, I don't know what. Everybody got screwed, not just me, but I thought it was just me. And so I'm pouting like a little kid, and I'm walking up this ramp, and I look over, and there's this picture of Albert Einstein. Right? And it says, "The two most important days of your life are the day you were born and the day you realized why." You know, the day you were born and the day you realized why. And I stood there, and you know when the tears come and you can't stop them? You know, and I'm sitting there and I'm looking. I see this lady was on the plane with me. She has one of those things around her neck. She has a bag to carry a dead person. And she has a suitcase with her blanket or something. It's like rolling over. And she's like, so I went down to her and I said, hey, my name is Jason. She said, my name is Ruth. And I said, hey, can I give you a hand? I think we're going to the same place. And I thought she was going to hand me the suitcase. And she gave me this big bag. It weighed like 40 pounds. And it has all these games in it. You know, and so we're walking to the thing and we start talking. And I found out that she, her grandkids, her son and her daughter-in-law were going on a cruise for 2 weeks. And her grandkids had saved their money so they could fly her over so she could babysit them for the 2 weeks. Because she doesn't usually get to do that. And she had every game in there, you know. And I got to get that. You guys have given me that gift. You taught me my responsibility in Alcoholics Anonymous is to serve other people. And the damnedest thing, she had a charger for my phone. Thanks, and have a great day.